Okay, thank you. Now it's time for a little science, which is what this group is all about. And Roy Gravel has kindly agreed to summarize some of the key accomplishments of former group members. Roy has been a member of the group since 1995 and served as its director from 1995 to 99 when he moved to Calgary, but he remained a member of the group until its end, despite this geographic challenge. He is currently professor and Killam Memorial Chair in the Department of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology in Calgary.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure for me to be here with you today and to go back and look at the accomplishments of the group. I have to tell you, it's not possible to summarize the accomplishments of the group at all. And it's particularly daunting to do so after Clark and Charles have given their comments. What I did pretty much instead was to look for tidbits of science and contribution that I thought were interesting and that I'd like to share with you. And that gets me off the hook if I pick something that the individual who did it will say, where did that ever come from? But I found them very interesting. So you see the group before you. There are 14 members over all of these years. And what I've done is I've made selections from people who aren't actually speaking today rather than to either take the risk of saying something foolish or to duplicate what they might have to say themselves. For Charles, Charles has done so much science within medical genetics, so much contribution to the translational side, to the basic science side. There's a paper just recently on the phenylalanine ammonia lyase that is going into preclinical trials. It's impossible to offer a science summary in the usual sense. But Charles has also been the conscience, if you like, of medical genetics and has kept us remembering how important it is that we pay attention to our genes. And he was the source of, with Barton Childs, in fact, was the source of a series of papers that span 25 years that were essentially on the progress that we have in treating genetic metabolic disease. Put another way, especially for Charles and Clark, has all this been worth it? And it's been worth it if we've had an impact on genetic disease and can translate not only into the prevention side, which has been a fairly effective thing in genetics, but also in the treatment side. So this was a series of papers, starting off with Teresa Costa, that had a look at the progress of activities. So what you see here is, first of all, rather than list, there were 65 genetic disorders that were summarized, starting back in 1985. And they are generally from metabolic disease and are from the categories that you see there, so 65 conditions. All 65 were looked at in these three periods of time, and except in this last cycle, which was recent, it was down to 64. So most of the disorders that were monitored over such a long period of time, 25 years, we get to see how the progress has been. So what you see here is a bar, the color representing the particular period of time that was looked at, and what we're seeing is that, for example, here out of the 65 diseases, 31 disorders had no response to treatment. These are disorders for which really nothing could be done. There was a very complicated and appropriate quantitative way of looking at improvement as a result of various modalities of treatment, and within that it was on a scoring system of 10 point. Group of 17 of these disorders in 1983 showed a little bit of response, not very much. And then we had, with significant improvement in response to interventions, 9 and then 8 for full response, truly treatable diseases. What you see in 1993 is a tiny bit of improvement from the no responders, if you like, into the partial improvement range. But you can see that really nothing was happening with significant improvement or full improvement in patients. In other words, in that first 10 years, we're not really seeing a very big change in quality of life for people with genetic disorders. But what's happened in the review of 2008 with Eileen Tracy is that while we are moving out of this zone, we're moving right up into full response and a very significant improvement. So we're seeing, in other words, finally, after some 20 plus years of science in genetics, we are seeing some improvement in genetic diseases that in the past really had not responded very much at all. So I think for this group of 65 metabolic disorders, we're really seeing the fruits of the labors as summarized by this effort. So full response, summarized here, went from about 12% over these two decades, and now pushing into three times that number, is a measure of where metabolic disease has gone. And I would offer the suggestion that people like Clark and Charles and members of the group have had significant contribution to make to that. What's interesting about it is if you look at the period of study here, that what we're seeing is while phenotypes have been improving in our understanding of them, in our description of them over this very long period of time, and certainly has shown dramatic advances during the period after the 1960s, it's really during the period of genotype that we're seeing also this clinical improvement in disease. In other words, yeah, it really is worth identifying genes, and from those genes, identifying approaches to treatment. And I think that's the measure here, that we've been able to see this translational component that Charles was referring to as a real connection between the basic science of gene identification to the ability to carry it into the clinic. And if I said it was difficult to do this for Charles, it's impossible to do it for Clark. So I had to have a really busy slide for you, if nothing else. And what was interesting here, I was scanning the literature, and Clark suffers from having done his work at a time when PubMed hasn't gone back that far yet. And so you can't pull the papers out. And I'm now a victim of PubMed. Our library is pretty well denuded of hardcover journals. So looking in the modern era and looking at things that interest me, I found this study, Nutritional Patterns of Mothers of Children with Neural Tube Defects in Newfoundland. Well, this has been a very special topic for this group, largely from the work that Reem has been doing, and I thought this was an interesting area for us to have a look. And what this really is, to try to stay brief about it, is it's an argument for nutritional intervention to prevent neural tube defects. And of course, the nutrient we all know is folate. What was interesting here is in the end, he had 25 neural tube defect mothers, mothers of children with neural tube defects, and 25 matched controls. I've never seen matching like this, and that's because I don't do this kind of science or I'm not bright enough to do it properly. But he sent somebody out into the communities where each individual was identified that had a child with neural tube defect to find a close-by match, somebody from the same area and somebody who had their children around the same time. So these were absolutely matched individuals, so 25 and 25. What was interesting, though, that the group characteristics weren't uniform. Mothers of children with neural tube defects tended to be younger, despite this one-to-one matching, tended to be heavier, and also were lower on an socioeconomic scale that with a particular kind of classification for it, which is interesting because we're doing a match situation that might have said that group characteristics would be similar. And what happened and what turned out to be translated over to here is these parameters are the beginning here, and I'm sorry these are hard to read, but the bottom line was that nutrition was quite different in the mothers of babies with neural tube defects. This is a description of the mothers, a comparison of the mothers of the of those children with their match controls as a percentage with respect to the parameters being looked at. And what you're seeing is the fruits and cereals and dairy products and so on are not as prominent in those mothers as they were in the mothers of the control matched individuals. Sweets are sitting high here. A lot of this was not significant, but as a group you can see the pattern is quite telling. And the bottom line when one looks at especially micronutrients, is that folate was very hard to look at because some of the control group mothers were on folate supplements, but not the others. But the bottom line was that mothers who had kids with neural tube defects were also looking to be low in their folate intake. And the conclusion and the effort of this study said what we now know to be true. Poor maternal nutrition and low dietary folate in particular increase the chance of having a child with neural tube defects. And it underscores the importance of supplementary folate. So this goes back into the 90s before we were really underway with folate supplementation. That's something we know very well. This was something I'd not known, and maybe Rima would know these, but a familial association between twinning and upper neural tube defects. The bottom line of this story is that if you look at the percent twinning in near relatives of probands with neural tube defects, it's in fact higher. The Canadian percentage, if you like, for having twins is about 1%. You don't really see it here very well, but you see it with kids with upper neural tube defects. They have relatives who tend to be twins. And if you look at the percent occurrence, let me read this, neural tube defect sibling occurrence rate in families with and without twins. In families with twins, there's a substantial increase in the percentage that have upper neural tube defects compared to families without twins. And the speculation that was put forward makes some interesting sense is that upper neural tube defects would be involved because the upper neural tube forms earlier than the lower and might be therefore more susceptible to the effects of early developmental delay as in utero as a potential explanation for this. So I thought this was a particularly interesting insight that Clark had brought forward. It gets tougher. I had to do some real science to read Susie's work, Susie Tannenhaus's work, and it was nice to be able to talk about something that I was hearing about from her when I was here in Montreal. But this is the identification of the PEX-G mutation in the hip mouse. The gene had been identified through a positional cloning effort in humans, but it was not understood, and I learned today from Andy and Susie, it's still not understood what this thing does. However, what she showed, first of all, was this is a big message. It's 7 kilobases long, and if you do RT-PCRs at the front end and at the back end, you find that the 3' prime end of the doing RT-PCR, that is, of the message, is missing in the hip mouse. It's, as you can see, there's a fragment detection here for normal. And so there's something funny going on with this particular gene. What's interesting about this is the phenotype of hip mice originates, if you like, from a reduction in sodium-dependent phosphate transport in the brush border of the kidney. And that's what this arrow is pointing to. So of course, one was looking for a kidney problem, and this PEX gene doesn't know about kidneys. And this, when you see something like this, you're looking for splice mutations and such. But in fact, she showed it to be a genomic loss at the 3' prime end of the gene. And that was back in the 90s. And so then I went looking forward to see if I could find what all this is about. It looked like an endopeptidase, but the science hasn't progressed, at least to identify the cause. What is truly interesting about it, I don't think I have another slide, is that it's in bone, and it really looks to be something that regulates phosphate homeostasis. This word is one word, or at least one name, one enzyme name. So I have deep respect for Bob McKenzie. And what we're describing here, fortunately, acronyms are everything. So this is a D for dehydrogenase, C for cyclohydrolase, S for synthetase, member of the folate pathway. And Bob's did a tremendous amount of research on this as a trifunctional enzyme. And what you see in the cytosol is this trifunctional protein. This goes through bacteria on up, if I'm understanding correctly. However, the finding in mammals is that there's only a bifunctional, if you like, two-component part of it, the D and the C. The S is an independent protein. What I thought was neat in the period that Bob's been part of our group, what I thought was neat was the mechanism by which this is known to be so. So the normal thing you might imagine is, for example, why would you get a trifunctional protein? Well, you might evolve a protein into three parts, or you might fuse a protein together to form a single component part. And there's evolutionary games that one can play to show these things happen. But this one, what they showed was in mouse human and Drosophila, the gene in the cytosol carries the D and C components at one end, the synthetase in the middle and towards the 3' side. But the mitochondrial version, in fact, has a long UTR, and that UTR, the untranslated component of it, actually carries blocks of sequence that is reminiscent of the synthetase. And this is true, especially in mouse and human, but even shows up in Drosophila. In other words, we kind of beat that end of the protein with a baseball bat until it was no longer a functional component, and we now had this difunctional thing, and the synthetase had to show up of its own accord. So I thought that was kind of cool. Now this I also, not from my time here, but know this very well. In Tay-Sachs disease, we use fluorescent substrates, methyl umbilliferal substrates, in order to do assays for this enzyme. The natural substrate, as most of you know, is GM2 ganglioside, and is not something you want to do assays of if you can help it. Peter Heckman, going back to 1984, developed a substrate, which is the what you see here, which is a sulfated version. And in using this particular substrate, synthesis of 4-methylumbilliferyl, if you like, glucagon sulfate, became a substrate that could be used for classification of GM2 gangliosidoses, Tay-Sachs, Sanhoff disease, GM2 activator. And what's really interesting about this is that this is a substrate now specific for hex A, the defect, if you like, or the deficient enzyme in Tay-Sachs. And in the past, the way we used to do this, and is still done as well, is to do such an assay with the standard substrate and then heat it to kill off the hex A, take the difference in hex A activity is calculated. And early on, Rennie Gold did some studies on the statistical approach to this. But what you see here with the 4-MUGS activity that Peter developed with respect to this substrate is that you can distinguish homozygotes, heterozygotes, and normal controls very nicely. So this was, to my mind, a very significant contribution that's been used for diagnostics as well as for enzyme studies as these enzymes were worked out. And I can't leave this without pointing out that the Peter and Faggy Kaplan put together the GM2 gangliosidosis database that really came out of the DeBell Center and still exists. And I was also noticing that there's now one for PEX, there's one for androgen receptor, and that people here have been keeping very busy making sure that the community at large is aware of the mutation load that we have in these disorders. So with my apologies to the scientists whose work I butchered, I would also, though, like to express a big thank you from all of us to CIHR-MRC for catalyzing 37 years of science. Thank you.